Hey guys and gals, welcome to Backyard Steakout Presents. I'm your host, James W.
And this is your co-host, Chef Linda.
Hey Linda, how's it going out there today?
Hey James, it's kind of cold here in West Virginia, but we're doing good.
Hey, we've got Sarah Artley from Oregon. And she's going to be on here telling us about her own creation of a rhubarb cobbler. She's up there in, 10 feet of snow?
Yes, well, she
is. Feel sorry for the people up there. It's a good thing she still got phone service to get into the recording. So, Sarah, are you there?
I am here. Thank you.
All right. You got an interesting recipe to go through us with, and we like to start, from the beginning, how you go about preparing everything, how much, and all that, just like you was explaining it to somebody over the phone, how to make it, and it's supposed to turn out exactly like yours does. So you think you could go through all that? Why, we go ahead and start talking about the rhubarb cobbler.
You bet. Well, this cobbler recipe I really like because it actually, you can use it with different fruits. I happen to prefer rhubarb, so that's the one we're doing today, but it can be adapted to other fruits. And so, and I usually, you can do this in the oven, but I like to do mine in a Dutch oven, one of the three-legged Dutch ovens with a rimmed lid, and actually do it outside, either over a fire or with briquette coals. And so that's the recipe I'll give you today. Instructions are with the briquettes because it's a little easier to control that heat, as a lot of people know. So I use a 12 to a 14 inch DO, and I go ahead and spray my cast iron. I don't know if other people do that, but I use a cooking spray in mine, and so I spray that up good. Get my coals good and hot ahead of time. If you have one of the chimneys, those work really good for starting coals, and I like to have probably 20 to 24 coals going at least to have ready. And so I get those going and heating up, and then I go ahead and get my recipe together. So once I've sprayed that Dutch oven, I go ahead and take my rhubarb. And again, quantities as far as your fruit goes are a little bit dependent on what you want. I use, between 5 and 7 cups of rhubarb that I've diced relatively fine. You don't have to, but I like it fine. And it can be frozen or fresh. Either way, doesn't matter. And I just drop that into the bottom of that Dutch oven. And then I go ahead and mix up my topping. And some of you are probably going to wonder where the sweetener and stuff is, but that's coming. Hold on. So in a bowl, I mix up I start with my sugar, butter, and salt, and so I take 3/4 of a cup of sugar. I cut into it about 1/2 cup of the butter into, small pieces like you were doing a pie crust or something. And then I'm going to add 1/8 teaspoon of salt, and I kind of mix that up first. And once I have that mixed up, I add in my flour. So there's 1 cup of flour, and I add 1 teaspoon of baking powder, and 3/4 cups of milk, and stir until that's just combined. Another little bit of a change I do on mine, this makes for a fairly thick batter. You can drop it on there like a traditional cobbler. I sometimes add a little extra milk to get it a little thinner consistency so I can spread it out a little easier and get more coverage, which is just how I like to do it. But I just add a little milk to do that. It depends on your preference. And just get that on the rhubarb. And then I'm going to take another small bowl, and I'm going to mix up a topping. So we're going to add in 1 cup of sugar and 1 tablespoon of cornstarch, and then just a pinch of salt and some cinnamon and nutmeg. That's kind of the taste. I use 1/2 to 1 full teaspoon of cinnamon, and then around 1/4 teaspoon of nutmeg. And any other spices, if I'm feeling a little adventurous that day, I might add in some cloves or whatever spices you like with your rhubarb, but that's kind of my basic recipe. And I sprinkle that sugar mixture on top of the batter that you spread on and just get it nice, evenly coated. And then the last step I don't do until I'm actually setting it on the coals. So once your coals are hot and you have a spot ready for it, I go ahead and put some coals in the hole or wherever the space is that you have made. And I only put probably 4 to 6 coals there on the bottom, even up to 8. It kind of depends on the size of your Dutch oven, but you don't want to burn that bottom while the top is baking. So just enough to give it a nice even heat under there, and so it's kind of cooking your rhubarb while your cobbler on top is cooking. And then I put that rimmed lid on there, and I put another 12 to 16 coals on top. So you're getting about 350 degrees, you know, 18 to 20 coals typically will get you 350 degrees, and that's what we're looking at for this recipe. And before I put that lid on, the very last thing I do is I take 1 cup of hot water, boiling water, and I pour it over the top of that sugar mixture that you put on top, and try to wet it the best I can, get it all wet, but I don't add any additional water if it isn't all wet. It'll pick up the moisture. And then I go ahead and put that lid on with those coals on it and let it do its thing there in the pit. It usually takes 1.5 to 2 hours doing it that way. And of course, you want to leave that lid on there and not be checking it too much, letting that heat out. Once it's been, you know, 1.5 hours, I'll peek at it and keep an eye on those coals and add more if I need to, if they're kind of disintegrating, to keep that heat up. But I just kind of watch it. When it's looking brown and bubbly, and I kind of check the dough in the middle to make sure it's done, we pull it out and serve it with some ice cream.
Oh, that
and that's it. It's
so
easy.
That is easy.
I have a question on
okay.
the...
Go ahead.
Okay.
When it's getting close to being done, between a separation between that crust and the Dutch oven?
Not as much as you see on other... Like with a cake or something, you start seeing it pull away. This doesn't do that quite so much. You start seeing, you know, it bubbling kind of up around the edges, but you don't see it shrinking the way you do on some other types of things you bake.
Do you grow your own rhubarb?
I have in the past, but we're kind of nomads. We like to move a lot, and it takes a while to get rhubarb started. So if I'm not someplace where I already have a patch, I buy it frozen, or I'll buy it from a local farmer's market or someplace like that. So I prefer my own, but it doesn't have to be.
How do you know when the rhubarb is ripe?
Well, rhubarb's kind of funny. I don't know that I'd say there's, and someone may be more knowledgeable about it than I am, but I've used it a long time, and there isn't really like the green stage is really green, and you can see that. When it starts getting that red running through the stalk, you know, it's pretty much ready to use, and then it will get more and more ripe as time goes on, but you can start using it then. You need to add more sugar and whatnot because it's kind of bitter in that early stage, but you can use it. It's a little more bitter when it's small and greener, but it's also sometimes more tender than when it gets, you don't want really big stalks because they tend to get pretty woody, and so they're not as good. But I prefer smaller, thinner stalks, so I like it as soon as it's out of the actual green stage and it starts turning a little bit of red. That's when I like to get it.
My mom had some rhubarb she grew, and there's rhubarb growing there. I guess when we moved into that place, I was like 5 years old then, but I lived there for till I went into the service, so I was like 17, and it never had to bother it. I mean, it was ripe, she'd go out and take some, and she'd use it until it was gone. And then the next year it would come
exactly.
back again. It wasn't really nothing as far as keeping up with it and everything, but it was just the point. I didn't know it takes a while for it to start growing because it's always
yeah.
been there, and she's used it a lot of times.
Right, and you can, so if you don't have any rhubarb, you can get starts off the internet from different places, and you just want to watch what zone you're in and make sure you get rhubarb that will produce in that zone and do well. But even once you get those starts, It's not full grown. You can't really cut it a lot until it's at least 3 years old. So you don't get a lot out of it until then. And, you know, you can let your patch grow or keep it cut back. But over the course of the summer, you know, last year, a fairly small patch can last you most of the summer if you are harvesting it properly and it just keeps growing. And so it's a really good kind of oddball, but fun fruit to have on hand.
Some people add strawberries to their rhubarb. Have you ever
used and strawberries? I do a strawberry rhubarb. Yeah, I do a strawberry rhubarb pie that I add strawberries to. I do not in my cobbler because strawberries tend to kind of just disintegrate and fall apart in that, and maybe that's okay. But I like the rhubarb just straight, but you could certainly could add the strawberries. But I prefer to keep that mixture for my pies.
Now, I have never ate a rhubarb.
Really?
You have.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's not very.
Go ahead.
It's not very good by itself.
I've never had rhubarb, but if you was going to explain to me what a rhubarb cobbler tastes like, what do you have to compare that to?
That's a good question. I don't know that it tastes like anything else. It's kind of a unique, you know, not another fruit off the top of my head. It can be just a little bit bitter, but it just has a pretty unique flavor and definitely a unique texture to it over other fruits, because actually I think it's technically more of a vegetable than it is a fruit. So it's just a real unusual one to try, and to try to describe it to somebody would be really hard. It just has a lot of flavor, and like I said, it can be a little bit bitter, but we offset that with some other things and just really bring out the true good flavor of it in the dishes.
Do you use whole milk or half and half, or what kind of milk do
you like
use?
Whole milk. I use 2% a lot because I don't think I need all that extra fat from, you know, whole milk, but I actually like whole milk better in the recipe.
Okay, makes sense.
You substitute a lot of 2% milk. I mean, that's about all I ever drank was 2%. Back when I was growing up, it was always fresh from the cow into the pasturator, and I never did like that because that's less than 1% milk. But we used to make butter out of it, too, when that butter wasn't really like you'd buy in a store either. You get used to it, but you just don't eat as much of it. When you're cooking on in the cast iron, now, you was talking about putting so many coals on the bottom and then do you double that amount on the top, or how is it you do that?
As a general rule of thumb, it entirely depends on what you're cooking. If you're actually using your Dutch oven as an oven, which we are doing essentially here, you kind of want your heat coming from the top. It depends on what you're cooking on the bottom, but typically the heat coming from the top is better for what you're baking. And so this kind of method where you put a few on the bottom but most of them on the top is also what you would use to bake a pie or bread or something in there. And if I'm doing a pie, I actually like invert another pie tin on the bottom and then put my pie on it so it's raised off the bottom a little bit and a little bit closer to the top. And then you can even out your coals a little bit more. But unless I'm making a stew or something like that, I keep my coals mostly on the top with just some on the bottom for using it that way.
You say that you make a cobbler. Like, have you ever made a rhubarb pie in a Dutch oven, the rhubarb pie?
I have. I've done rhubarb and strawberry rhubarb pies, and I've done breads. And, you know, we do pack trips where we're out in the wilderness for 4 or 5 days at a time. And I actually take a Dutch oven with me, and I will make up things before we go but not bake them. Typically, sometimes I bake them and reheat them this way, but I'll freeze them and take them to bake out there. You know, it makes a real nice presentation. So, yeah, I've done pies and breads and all sorts of different things in my DO.
Okay.
But in that case, I have another pan that sits inside the Dutch oven. The Dutch oven is not the Dutch oven becomes the oven, and there's another pan that the pie or the bread or whatever is in. In that case, bread, you don't have to do it quite so much, but sometimes I do. But like I said, I invert another pie tin and then set my pie tin with the pie in it on that, and then all of that is inside the Dutch oven.
Oh, okay.
I've seen when they cook in something like that, a cake or something in a Dutch oven, they'll do the same thing. But what do you call those cakes with the hole in the middle?
The guy, like an angel food?
Yeah. It's got the big cake with the hole in the middle of it. He would spray the inside of the cast iron with the spray oil, and then he would put some flour in there and just kind of slide it around and get it where the flour was stuck all the way around the bottom and the sides of the Dutch oven. And then he would take like a pork and bean can or a green bean can, and he'd cut out both ends of it, and he would spray that and put flour all around it and shake it loose. And then he would set that right in the middle of his Dutch oven and then pour the mix in around it. And he'd leave that in there until it was done. And then after he was done, he would take that pork and bean can and just twist it a couple times, and then it would just slide right out of there. He always cut the cake in the Dutch oven. He wouldn't try to get it out, you know, because he's afraid that it would not fall apart. So he would cut it in slices in there and just use, he said, the first slice is hard to get out without breaking it. But after that, they all come out real good and easy.
I might have to try that on our next trip. That's one I haven't done, and I'm sure our guests would be quite impressed if we could cook an angel food cake out there on the trail, take along some strawberries. That'd be quite a treat.
Boy, that would.
That's what this guy does. He's been a cook on the trails for 20 or 25 years cooking out on trails. And so now he's just spending his time doing videos and stuff. Kent Rollin.
Yes.
And he does all the cast iron cooking on the fire. And he uses just all wood. He's got a big heating stove or whatever, and he heats up all his wood and gets it all into nothing but coals. And then he'll have a shovel that's got about 6 holes in it, probably about the size of a large aspirin bottle. He'll scoop up some of that coals, and he'll shake that shovel a little bit, let some of the dead ashes fall out, and then he'll just put that around his Dutch oven. But he don't put it underneath the Dutch oven. He puts it around it, right on the edge of it.
A lot depends on the type of Dutch oven you have. You know, mine has feet. You can use them without feet, and then you would just put it around rather than sitting your... You don't want that bottom sitting directly on your heat, whatever it is. So if it has feet, it keeps it up off of it. But if it doesn't have feet, then you go ahead and sit it on the ground and kind of put your coals around it. And I've used wood. You know, it's a little hard for someone who hasn't done it to get the knack of that. Wood can be a little tricky in some instances, especially if you're baking bread or something where you really need a good constant heat and to know what that temperature is. And we have a lot of soft woods out here in the West. We don't have the good hard woods that you find in some other states. So that makes keeping them hot and getting the right temperature pretty tricky. So that's why I usually, you know, recommend people use the briquettes. But when we're on the trail, we don't want to have to pack briquettes along. So we use wood also almost exclusively when we're out doing that sort of thing.
I bet you have a lot of mistakes under your belt.
Yes, lots of mistakes.
Okay, yeah, well, that really sounds interesting. I'm thinking, you know, anytime anybody cooks out in a cast iron skillet outside, or even, you know, I use cast iron inside and outside, and it's really, you're right, you know, it's a good thing they clean up so easy, because I can't imagine cooking cakes and stuff like that and gobblers in a Teflon.
Cast iron cooking it tastes so much better. When you make your cobbler, I know you time it. And didn't you say you don't take the lid off to check it?
Correct. Yeah, I mean, I do kind of time it. It's not like a normal recipe where you say let it cook for an hour and it should be done. This is one you have to kind of feel your way through. I typically allow it, like I said, at least an hour and a half before I check it. And then before I take the lid off, because, you know, when you're cooking that way, as soon as you take the lid off, you're losing a lot of your heat, and it has to get back up to temperature to keep cooking. So it really slows things down every time you lift that lid. So I give it, you know, an hour and a half, and then I check it.
That makes sense.
That old saying, Linda, if you're looking, you're not cooking.
Yeah, that's true. If you're looking, you're not cooking.
And I will say, if anybody wanted to do, you know, that same recipe, but not have to do it outside or with the coals, you can do this in the oven as well. And you'd bake it at 350 degrees, and it takes a little bit less time, an hour probably, to an hour and 10 minutes to get that rhubarb cooked through and all of your batter cooked through. And most of my recipes actually actually are adapted for high elevation. So people may want to cut down their cooking times a little bit and be checking them the first time or two they do it, because if you're lower than 6,000 feet, it's of course going to affect the cooking time from my recipe, which has always been for 6, 7, and 8,000 feet.
Wow, I'm going to have to keep my eye on mine then, because I'm only at about 17 feet. It's pretty flat down here in Florida.
Yeah.
Sarah, we sure appreciate you coming on the radio here and giving us your information and stuff. And we hope we can have you back on here sometime with another recipe that maybe we find out if somebody tried that, we can hear and talk about it, see how it went for them.
That'd be great.
Thank you so much, Sarah. You gave us a lot of information.
You bet. Thank you.
Yes, you have. All right. Well, until next week, cook with heat. That's what I'm saying. Thank you. We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.